Hello, welcome to the New River Church podcast. We're so pleased to have you join us today. We hope that today's message uplifts and inspires you. If you would like to learn some more about New River Church and what we're all about, just check us out at newriverchurch.org.
This morning, I want to introduce to you Paul Veit. Paul, I first met Paul, oh boy, a long 20-some years ago at a district conference. And back then, he's a pastor, and he's just starting this ministry. And I think, oh, cool, here's a preacher with some dinosaur bones. That's kind of nice. That's cute. He's got a small collection. Over the years, though, my goodness, God has expanded his ministry around the world. And I don't know. He'll tell you more about it, I guess.
But,
right? Don't you have like the largest collection of Neanderthal brains or something? It's something something odd like that that nobody else would have.
I'm definitely got odd stuff.
Yes. So, Paul, thank you so much for your ministry. We bless you today.
Thank you, brother. Thank you. Yeah, one time I was saying to my wife, honey, it's a little loud. And I was saying to my wife, honey, you know, we're bringing a lot of stuff home from these yard sales. She looks at me and she goes, at least I didn't have to build a building for my junk. So yeah, I do have some stuff. Why study this topic? I could not count the number of people that have come up to me and said, my son, my daughter was raised in the church. She was in the youth group. She was a leader in the youth group. He went to everything you could possibly imagine, went to college, got close to this teacher. Some of these teachers have been honing their attack arguments for 25 years, and our students are often not ready for them. And so this topic is very important on an eternal soul level. And so I do travel full time. I have a website, Evangelistic Events. I've gotten hard stone digging experience. I've got soft stone digging experience. And in the last 18 years that I've been on the road, I've done over 1,600 outreaches. I also do different large youth ministries. The last couple I did the last couple weeks, I was down at Teen Missions doing their boot camp. I do basically in the morning, creation versus evolution, evening, talking to their souls. And I'll tell you, the response of the generation today, what's happening in this generation today is actually awesome. I don't think there's been a generation that you could tell the difference between good and evil so clearly. You can't miss it now. And so then I went from Teen Missions, I went to Youth with a Mission. I do training with the Philly branch, the Boston branch, and the Pittsburgh branch. And again, these kids are going, you know, the Teen Missions kids are going to 13 different countries. These guys are sending five teams out to do evangelism for 3 weeks. They led over 500 people to the Lord, by the way, in three weeks. And when we give altar calls, there's a difference that has occurred since when I started this. When I started this, you'd have to have some time with the kids to get them to the point where they're really, truly, purely worshiping the Lord and allowing him to speak to their souls. Now, man, they are purely worshiping the Lord. They're open to what God's telling them. I mean, the Teen Missions won 300 kids at the altar for half an hour just talking to God. This Youth with a Mission altar call, 150 kids at the altar, 45 minutes talking to God in silence. It's amazing what God is doing, and it is a battle for souls. I do have a Creation Evidence Museum in Maine, and we bring some groups there. This is the open-air campaigner, missionaries who preach in cities, and they came for two reasons. They wanted to address better the creation evolution issue, and they also wanted to deal with the alien issue that is coming up all the time on the streets in all these cities. It is clearly a generational-related issue. And in my generation, 10% believed in real aliens and other planets. Today's generation, 75% believe in real aliens and other planets. So when their teacher tells them, oh yeah, we don't have any transitional forms leading up to an octopus. The octopus was cryogenically frozen and seeded on Earth by aliens. They believe it with scientific intensity. And so I had to address that topic. And since there's 5 billion people on the internet, we put everything on the internet for free. Not like buy this, look at this. No, it's all on there for free. So if you want to do the human transitional forms, what's wrong with the human transitional forms? Why didn't a space speck become a sea slug, become a fish, become a rat, become a common ancestor, become you? Why didn't that happen? Just take a look at that one. Today we're doing creation, evolution, dinosaurs. It's a good place to start, but it is literally the tip of the iceberg. And if you have a young adult or if you're interested in the topic, I would start with the did life come from Mars, which is where the world's at right now. But today we're going to do dinosaurs. We knew there was going to be some more kids in here, and we just wanted to deal with that. The Bible starts right away talking about something, a concept. And in Genesis 1, we read, so God created the great creatures of the sea according to their kinds. Every winged bird according to its kind. God saw that it was good. God made the wild animals according to their kind. The livestock according to their kind. All the creatures that move along the grounds according to their kind. So God says over and over again in the first chapter of the Bible, I created according to their kind, according to their kind, according to their kind. He knew evolution would show up, saying one kind became another kind. Different when it comes to men and women. I created you in the image of God. Whoa. Totally distinct from the animals. Not as a mammal, as a human. Distinct from the animals. So from a biblical perspective, you would have literally iron walls between the kinds. So digging into the dinosaurs, how many kinds of dinosaurs are there? This is an important topic because I've heard this all the time. Come on, how can you possibly think the dinosaurs were on the ark? There's thousands of kind of dinosaurs, hundreds of kind of dinosaurs. Let's take a look at this. The problem that they had started with these three skulls. They looked at the skulls and they said, there's a lot of similarities in these three skulls. They lined it up, the snouts, and some of the names are very evil, actually. Dracorex, not such an evil name, but Stygimoloch is a wretched name from the pit, really. That's the river to the god Moloch. That's the one that they sacrificed babies to in the Old Testament. So they lined up these three snouts, and they said, you know, the snouts on these dinosaurs actually look the same. They weren't allowed to have Dracorex, really, because that was the one that the knights killed, and yet Dracorex ended up being the real deal. And so they said, Dracorex looks a lot like Stygimoloch, looks a lot like Pachycephalosaurus. And basically, if you look at the top of their heads, you'll see Dracorex is the young one on the left with horns sticking out the back. And basically, as it ages, it absorbs the horn and develops a dome. So it ends up kind of like this in the end when you get into your 60s. So actually started probably in my 30s, but you know, it's well-defined at the end. And so they said, this isn't three dinosaurs. This is one dinosaur getting older. Same thing with the Triceratops series. It started with the Torosaurus on that one. They said, well, you got this Torosaurus that's like as big as a car. The skull's as big as a car. The body's as big as a school bus. But why have we never found baby Torosauruses? It was because they misunderstood what was happening. This is not six dinosaurs. This is the dinosaurs getting older, right? When they're children, the horns are pointed up. Aren't you happy about that? Can you imagine your kids running around, horns pointed at each other's faces, right? So they get into battle position as they get older to defend the family. And yeah, it wasn't six dinosaurs. It was one dinosaur getting older. Same thing with the Rex series. Nanotyrannosaurus had 17 teeth as it got older. It had 12 teeth. Museum and Iraqi specimen 555, 12 teeth. It wasn't because there was 4, 5, 6, 7 kinds of T-Rexes. It was one getting older. Slashed, diced, and sliced down to 15 kinds of dinosaurs, which we've been saying the whole time, but 15 kinds of dinosaurs. Did the dinosaurs evolve into birds? I was taught that. Well, started with the horse, and then it was the whale. The next generation, this current generation, is the birds. We just read a verse, right? God created every winged bird according to its kind. What? But in school, I learned the dinosaurs evolved into birds. In the Bible, I'm learning the birds were created as birds. One must be true, one must be false. Now, let me tell you, when you start here, you never get messed up. So let's dig into this. Archaeoraptor was the first one out, paid a fortune for it, came out of China, came out on the cover of National Geographic magazine and numerous other magazines, literally in a multi-million dollar release. Unfortunately, they never CAT scanned before they do the release. And when they actually CAT scanned the University of Texas by all evolutionists, they were shocked to discover that it was actually made of 88 different pieces of bone and stone, giving new meaning to the words made in China. Now, CAT scan before you release. Isn't that a good process? CAT scan before you release. Confucius Ornus, they said, man, maybe we should CAT scan Confucius Ornus. That's in millions of textbooks all over the world. That's a graduate level stuff, right? Confucius Ornus was so pathetic, you could see air bubbles, separation joints, glue that held it all together. And they started to panic, even little pieces of metal that came off the file when they filed it down. When they started to panic, they assembled a team led by Dr. Alan Fiducia, diehard evolutionist. Everybody he put on the team was a diehard evolutionist, and everybody was considered, including him, a bird expert. They examined every single dino bird there was and did not find a true feather in any of them. Let me give you the quote. I'll translate the quote for normal people like me. What they found was it wasn't a feather. It was a collagenous fiber meshwork that formed feather-looking patterns during decomposition. Dinosaurs dying, it's decomposing in the skin, are collagen fibers. They desperately, desperately wanted them to be a prototype developing feather. They were not. They were simply collagen fibers. All the dino birds fell apart in one swift motion. I'm out in Blanding, Utah. I'm out there with my brother looking for dinosaurs. And I went to this museum owned by a paleo artist who draws the pictures. And I was interested to see what was inside because the dino bird thing had fallen apart and probably 70% of this museum was dedicated to the dino bird. Now, this is a Deinonychus. I have a 6-foot fleshed out one at our museum. And this is my era, John Wayne, macho Deinonychus, right? He's covered with scales. Now, there's a placard underneath him that says, and look at the words here. Instead of using speculative imagination to justify the possibility of feathers, the original depictions of Deinonychus were conservative and had a scaly hide as was seen in the mummified dinosaurs. It was covered with scales. That's not the Deinonychus of this generation. That one behind it is the Deinonychus of this generation covered with feathers. And the placard under that says, feathers still have not been discovered with the fossils of Deinonychus, but that's what your kids get, and that's what, because they want you them to believe that dinosaurs evolved into birds. They want it to look something like this, and it actually doesn't look like that at all. It actually, real science, good science, would actually say covered with scales. Now, Archaeoraptor, the first one out, was $80,000. When you do not see them in the ground, it's called in situ. When you never see a picture of them in the ground, there's something very wrong. I found something in the Connecticut River Valley in a trackway I was working on that wasn't allowed to be there by the time frame that evolutionists have. Within 5 minutes, 30 pictures were taken. When you don't see them in the ground, there's something very wrong. When they're coming off the same factory line, there's something very wrong. So drop to $2,000. Now, I try not to get in trouble, but periodically I do get in trouble. I try to behave. It's kind of a guy thing, right? You know what I'm talking about, right? So I'm at the Denver Fossil Show. I walk up to the dinosaur bird factory table. I look at the birds and I started to laugh. The guy goes, why are you laughing? I said, because like I can't quite figure out how you got all 15 of these fossilized birds to pose in the same exact place. I mean, you know, it's ridiculous. It's become ridiculous. Our dinosaur is millions of years old. Now, Paul, this is science. This is radiometric dating. This is like science. Like what could possibly be wrong with that? Isn't that like the proof? I'm gonna give you a couple observations that I've seen. The first thing is, it was when you watch the stone form, the dates are always wrong. Evolutionists tell us when stone forms in volcanic situations, it starts at day one. Dr. Stephen Austin went up to the top of Mount St. Helens about 20 years after the dome forming events, which were in the 80s. So he goes there 20 years later, gets off two samples. Tates come down to the Geochron Dating Lab in Cambridge, Mass., considered one of the oldest and best in the country. It was 20 years old. We watched it form. Came back 2.8 million years old. It was only off by 2.8 million years. We watched it form. And you could do any of these around the world. This is another example. The oldest this one could possibly be was 1949. Came back 35 million years old. So when you watch it form, the dates are wrong. When two things are together, the dates are wrong. This is Crescent Mine, Cripple Creek, Colorado. There's volcanic rock. Within the volcanic rock, there is wood. They dated the wood inside the volcanic rock. They dated the rock. The wood came back at 41,000 years old. The volcanic rock came back at 32 million years old. When it's side by side, it's always wrong. And if you want to get into the formulas and discuss why that is, I'd be glad to discuss that with you, but it wouldn't be proper to do this morning. It's just too much. When you look inside, the dates are wrong. Like if I asked Pastor Doug, Pastor, go home, count to 65 million. You would never see him again, like ever. Like one guy tried to count to a million and quit after 3 months. 65 million, like literally is virtual immortality. It's so long. So why are we finding blood in dinosaur fossils? Real blood. This is the guy who actually mentored me. I've had a couple guys mentor me, but this is Joe Taylor, and just, I mean, amazing paleontological guy, total creationist. I found the first soft tissue, which is collagen fibers. Not mummified collagen fibers, not mineralized collagen, fresh collagen fibers in T-Rex bone. They've found DNA in dinosaur bones. DNA, we know from experiments, is only lasting thousands of years. How can it now become virtually immortal in dinosaur bone? They found unfossilized dinosaur bone, like fresh as yesterday's chicken, with marrow intact and soft. They found B-Rex. B-Rex changed the course of everything for the first time. They started actually opening them up and looking inside. Soft tissue galore. Veins that literally stretched out and snapped back like a rubber band. And people looked at that and said, man, that does not look 65 million years old. And it doesn't. They turned to hadrosaur bones, probably the largest quantity of one type of dinosaur that we have. They found the same soft tissue, the same veins that stretched out and released and snapped back full of blood. They refused to release the pictures for 2 years because that does not look old. So the stuff inside looks young. They found skin. I was supposed to be on this dig, but I had a tumor in my leg. I couldn't be on, well, the next dig too, but they actually found real skin. Not a skin impression, but real skin. This is a Creation Research Society dig. They found a Triceratops horn, and inside the horn, you can literally watch the soft tissue that they found bob up and down in a Petri dish. It was totally soft. Now, creationists, now we have guys that are highly educated. Dr. Mark Armitage was there. He has a doctorate in electron microscope stuff. Worked out of the, taught at the University of California in Northridge. Took pictures of the cells and connective tissue, not mineralized, not mummified. This is like the stuff that's in you. And it didn't look old at all. He released a secular article. When I say secular, I mean it didn't mention God. It didn't mention creation. All it mentioned was soft tissue, a soft tissue find. When he went back to the University of California, Northridge, to teach, his boss stormed into his office and said, "We are not going to put up with your religion at this university. You're fired." Just for publishing a soft tissue find, never mentioning God. If you want to go get a paleontological degree, and they find out you're a creationist and you believe the Bible, you're not allowed in the program. That's the way it is. These are from my museum. These are Santana Formation fish, supposed to be 92 million years old. They did an experiment up in Canada. They put Santana Formation fish into an acid bath for a couple hours, took off the scales, and there was filet underneath. This is not like mummified filet. That's not mineralized filet. This is like invite you to lunch filet. Yeah, 92 million years old. This abelamite, at the bottom you could see it's releasing an inky substance from an ink sac. They found an ink sac and they said, man, this is like super rare. This is stone that's supposed to be 150 million years old. What's this ink sac doing here? They took a pen, they put it inside the ink sac, and they drew the picture of that animal using its own ink. Is that really 150 million year old ink? And they said, it's so rare, it's never gonna have any. Well, I have three of them. So yeah, it's not that rare. So little Mary Annings in Lyme Regis, she's finding these sea creatures. She found so many ink sacs, she gave them to people in her town to draw pictures of the animal that she was finding. Fossil amber is really called technically plant resin, contains a lot of things. And they were examining bees and looked in their intestines and found living bacteria in the bee's intestines. Can bees actually be 25 million years old when they have living bacteria inside their intestines? They found yeast in amber. If you work with yeast, you know it's alive. It produces waste. Would it not poison itself in far less than 45 million years? Of course, leave it to the guys from California to try to make beer out of it, of course. So this is Alberta's millennial mine. They load it with plesiosaurs, and then they find this literally a tank with feet. And they look at its back, and this is not a model of it. This is actually it. And the sheaths on its back, the pointy thing, kids, that are coming up there, that's made out of keratin, like your fingernails, intact, soft, ready to go. I don't know. Mammoths, obviously, different situation. I'll have a whole one. I do an ice age, et cetera. Do much more mammoths. But mammoths is the same deal. They look down at the foot. It's bleeding all over the place. Is that really old stuff? Now, what about cloning? Cloning's a big deal. And you will probably see a cloned mammoth in your lifetime. I think that's pretty easy to think that that will happen. It might even be in the next 10 years. They're gonna put it in an elephant and they're gonna breed backwards because it's the same kind, the same biblical kind. Now, what's that mean? If you got DNA that's so fresh that you're using it to breed backwards, it's not old. It's fresh. They're trying the same thing with dinosaurs and it's not working. Why? Because they're trying to put it in a chicken and it's not working. So, hey, maybe you could do stuff with those chickens you got, buddy. You never know, you never know. All right, so cloning is like, if you can actually clone that DNA, man, you're working with young stuff in my mind. Did dinosaurs interact with man? Now, this is where, and I get it, you know, if there's people watching online, it's a journey. I know it's a journey. I didn't arrive there. I was an evolutionist. And I came to Christ, and I was confused. I was a confused evolutionist. And it's a journey. Take the journey and try to learn what you can learn and think about. Try to take as much time to look at the other side, to look at the creation side, and see what's really true and see if God reveals things to you. Obviously, evolutionists would say there is no way man ever interacted with dinosaurs. They're at least 63 to 65 million years apart. You read the Bible, whoa, land animals, day six. Man, day six, living at the same time. Well, what evidence is there of that? Well, let's start with actually the Bible. Tyndale translated the New Testament into English, and that was forbidden. And he was burnt at the stake for doing it. Next guy came around. And he wanted to translate the Old Testament. His name was Matthews. So he translated the Old Testament using a different name, obviously. And I want to show you how he translated the first time into English. This is Isaiah 34, 13. It's old English, so it's hard to understand, but you'll see it there. Thorns that grow in the palaces, nettles and thistles in their strongholds, that the dragons may have their pleasure therein. That was a very understandable term. You see all that term all through the book of Revelation. It was an animal that they understood. Rare, yes, but they clearly understood the animal. Lots of examples from old literature. This is 1500s, dinosaur. It's an old German. A dinosaur came out of a river and came onto land. They drew the picture of it in the 1500s. Going to France, this is the French king's little hunting cabin. Now, we got hunting cabins up in Maine, where I live, right? They don't look like that. In fact, I don't think there's anything in Maine that looks like that. And there's this hunting cabin. And like the kings, they had to have an animal to represent their reign, right? So I kind of get this, right? This guy picks the porcupine. Now, I had a serious porcupine issue. I had a porcupine under my stairs chewing on my house in the middle of winter. Those guys are fearless. Right? I'm waving everything I can think of at this thing. I'm yelling at it. It's not even moving. Right? I mean, I get it. Like, I am the porcupine king. If you mess with me, I will stab you in the face with my quills. Like, I get that, right? So this king throne room had a different animal. They all had different animals. There's his animal over there, over the fireplace. And now, he's not allowed to know what a dinosaur is, because this is hundreds of years before he's allowed to know what dinosaurs. So that is a salamander. Now, like, I'm not kidding. That's what they say. That is a salamander. Interesting. Only salamander I've ever seen that has a dinosaur head. Only salamander I've ever seen with dermal spines, those lumps going down its back, with scales breathing fire out its mouth. It's a very interesting salamander. So come over here. That's that. And over here, behind the kind of the queen's chair, is another dinosaur and a tapestry that was made in the 1400s. But like, why is that chair right there? Why wouldn't it be over by the king? Oh no, it's right there because there's something on that tapestry they don't want you to see. Another dinosaur and another third dinosaur. And what's amazing is I'm going to blow this guy up, highlight him, and I'm going to show you something on his back. We call those little things Rosetta patterns. We didn't have a clue what those were till 2007. These things are not just anatomically accurate, they're anatomic perfection, literally. So, St. George's Chapel, here's a altar cloth made in the 1600s, hundreds of years before you're allowed to know what dinosaurs are. And Sir George is slaying what? When you know your dinosaurs, you know that's a nothosaurus. You can tell by the teeth, that's the only dinosaur really looks like that. And is St. George slaying a nothosaurus? He certainly could have. It would have been an easy size to slay. Carlisle Cathedral, you're not allowed to roll this carpet up. This is a museum. They take paper, they put it on the brasses, they take the dark stuff, they have the image rise up onto the paper. You can't make a paper image of this tomb. It's forbidden. That's the last time that carpet was rolled up. Why? Because it's hundreds of years before you're allowed to know what dinosaurs are. He loved fish, he loved dogs, he loved birds, he loved bats. He loved long-necked dinosaurs. He loved armored dinosaurs. And on the long necks, he got the head right when we got the head wrong and named it a brontosaurus. Had the wrong head. Put the right head on it, renamed it a apatosaurus. He got it right. He loved triceratops. He loved dinosaurs. So, I contact the museum. It's the curator is a lady. It's a church. It used to be a church, and now it's a museum. And I said, I would like to get a brass rubbing of Bishop Bell's tomb. And she writes me back, no, I'm not going to sell you one. I said, why? She said, because those are animals of his imagination. They're not real. And I think you think that they're dinosaurs. And they're not. They're mythical animals of his imagination. So I'm not going to sell you one. I said, listen, I'm typing this, right? Get a book on dinosaurs. Put it down next to his tomb. And you're going to see they're not just dinosaurs. They're accurate dinosaurs. Amazing. Utterly amazing. Let's go to these coins. Now, this is a Angel Michael slaying the dragon. But what's interesting in this, the dragon is so incredibly precise. It's actually a Carnotaurus. And it's so precise, it gets the lumps right on its snout. It gets the horns right on the top of its head. It gets the dermal spines down its back. It gets the rear anatomy of the leg properly done. It got the scales perfectly done. Again, anatomic perfection. And Assazi drew pictures of them on the walls. Oh, that's got to be a cow. They're not allowed to know what dinosaurs are. Down in Peru, the Inca, the Ica, the Nazca, the Paracas, Tinahuaco, they're all living there. And some of them are struggling in the desert and they're having hard times and they're drawing these things on the desert. This hummingbird is a length of 3 football fields. It's almost like a lot of theories on this, but it's almost like they're saying to their gods, which were not our God, but not the true God, you know, there's we need water. There's living beings down here. We need water. And they also drew dinosaurs. Alberto Jacinto, who's in charge of the Nazca line, says, yeah, my opinion, they're dinosaurs. Maria Reich, who walked those lines for, I don't know, 40 years, the expert, the absolute expert, made an encyclopedia of the Nazca lines and put those in a section that she called her dinosaur collections. Palestrina mosaic, well, that's got to be a cow that Ethiopian warrior is attacking. It can't be a dinosaur. It's not allowed to be. I could give you literally another hour of these. We simply don't have the time. I'm just giving a snapshot of interaction. Could dinosaurs fit on the ark? You look at Argentosaurus, it's like basically the length of 3 football fields. So no, that dinosaur can't fit on the ark. But that is grandma and grandpa dinosaur. That's a dinosaur alive 100 years. They don't stop growing. They don't got the same caps on their bones like we got. Man, if you were growing, still growing for 100 years, right? You'd be like up there, right? That's what happened to them. So what was the purpose of the animals on the ark? The purpose was to reproduce and fill the earth again. And so they would have brought the juveniles. The largest juvenile we got would fit. It's literally smaller than the size of a basketball. So you got 15 dinosaurs, male and female. You got 30 dinosaurs this big. Would they fit on the ark? Easy. When they got off the ark, what has changed? Like everything. The massive quantity of them are in the flood sediments, but the ones that get off are facing a giant change. If you got the body size of 3 school buses, you got to eat a lot. You need probably 3,000 or 4,000 pounds of vegetation per day. Before the flood, there were 30-foot ferns. You could still see 30-foot ferns. There's one in the Grand Canyon right across from where you put in when you start rafting, 60, 70 feet long. But 30, 40, very common, foot-long ferns. We got 4-foot-long ferns. Big food's gone. Cold for the first time. Fountains of the Great Deep rip apart. Crust of the earth is moving. Water's coming up. Oceans are super warm. Thousands of volcanoes going off around at the same time, pumping the junk into the atmosphere, reflecting the good stuff from the sun. So you got super warm water, super cold air produces super ice dumps. Cold for the first time. Not only do they lose their food, but they can't survive the cold. They're absolutely not made to survive the cold. That's why the mammoth becomes the big guy in the block. Much smaller food requirement, much better ability to survive the cold. This is pretty important. They looked at the atmosphere inside the air bubbles. Now, the amber, the plant material, the plant resin is being cooked out during the flood. It's oozing out, and insects are getting caught in there, landing on stuff, trying to survive. It's also folding over, it's moving around, and it captures water from the flood and air from the flood. You can have some pieces with water, air from the flood moving around inside the water, little bubbles. They took that atmosphere out, and they were literally shocked. It was 32% oxygen. Our oxygen is 19 to 21%. They had way more oxygen than we got. And if you had that oxygen today, you could have outrun all the gold medalists from the last week with no problem whatsoever. You would heal better. You would live longer. Now, obviously, us not live longer was God saying too much evil has filled the earth. That's why that happened. But you would be healthier, much healthier. What about the graves in the water? We're doing great on time, Pastor. I'm cruising along here. Graves in the water. So your pastor gets stuck down in Miami. That's a great place to get stuck. I mean, if you're going to pick out a place that has swimming pools, like, I'll be there, right? Let's get stuck there. So he's swimming around and he gets this idea. Why don't we put a swimming pool out in the parking lot? No, I'm just kidding. Obviously. You don't have enough parking, right? No, but if he did and he filled it with water, I'd come down for a little experiment. We get all of you in the swimming pool. Then we dump in 10,000 goldfish. Little slimy, but it's important for the sacrifice for the experiment. You get it, right? Then we'd back up like 30 dump loads of dirt and dump it on your head. What's going to happen? All of you are going to die. But a couple of the goldfish might make it and repopulate. It's basically what happened to the crust of the earth. Crust of the earth rips apart. Sediment's taken out the lower layer. The trilobites taking the fish. I have guys say to me, well, if man was alive at the time of the trilobites, why don't you find them right there with them? Because they're not living on the bottom of the ocean. We're not living on the bottom of the ocean. Takes out the trilobites, takes out the bigger stuff. So let's look at a bigger stuff here. If you got an alligator that could bite at 2,500 pounds per square inch and a T-Rex can do about 3,000 pounds per square inch, a pliosaur could do 12,000 pounds per square inch. This is a T-Rex of the ocean on steroids. So they find one on a Siberian island. They pull out the head and this is a big discovery. That's just the head. And Predator X comes out. That's what they called it. Again, multi-million dollar release. All right, and they give explanation. One died, sank to the bottom. Most people attack on there and was deprived of oxygen because that's the next step that usually they say. And one died and was fossilized. So, like, what do you do in the next summer when it finally defrosts again on that island? You're going back, right? So why don't you see Predator X Part 2? Like, what happened? Why isn't it there? They found stuff the next time. This site is densely packed with skeletons. As we speak, there's probably more than 1,000 of them weathering out. Now, that's a problem. Because from an evolutionary perspective, one dying, falling to the bottom of the ocean, that's easy to explain. But now you're literally fossilizing the ocean instantly. That's very much harder to explain. But if you believe a flood, you can understand that perfectly. The land animals are dying in what I call the classic death position. The head is thrown back. Usually, when I was in geology, I learned that this happens after death. You see the head's thrown back. And they said that what happens is that they dry out. So they decided to do an experiment. They pinned a bunch of muscles and tendons to a board. They salted them, they radiated them, they did everything they could that they could think of to them, and they couldn't even get the muscles to contract enough to pull the pins out of the board. And so they decided what we've been telling all these students, it's not the case. They changed their mind and they said, no, this is actually the result of agonizing death throes. They're literally being fossilized during the process of dying, not later on. The head's thrown back. The mouth is gasping for air. The spine is bent painfully. You could see the pain in the way the legs are pulled into the body. You could see the pain in the way the toes are. Unbelievable. Now, let's talk about the sedimentary layers. Notice they are very straight and very flat. Now, Nick Walenda is walking across this steel thing at the Grand Canyon, this little steel cable. And I'm looking at it on TV. And I'm there with my wife, who's awesome. Her name's Judy. And I go, look at how straight those lines are. Why can't people see how straight those lines are? They're like, she's like, honey, I know the lines are straight. And she's like, I know. You've said that many times. The lines are so straight. So I raft the Grand Canyon. And this is the restroom at the bottom of the Grand Canyon. Yeah. Only restroom you'll ever use that you could see 2 miles in every direction with rafts going by. So there's the bottom restroom. All right, you bring that with you, by the way. It's not just installed there. It's you bring that with you. But look at the lines across the river. Dead straight. Go up to the middle. Dead straight. Go up to the top. Dead straight. So you got two choices. I had a doctor, a surgeon actually, from Boston who lives in Andover, Mass. And we were discussing this at one of my conferences. And I said, you need to go out there yourself and look at how straight those lines are. He went out there and rented a helicopter for the day and said, just fly. And he called me up. He goes, you're right. Those things are too straight. So here's your options. You're only allowed to have one option in school. I'm going to give you two. Option one, Millions of years of mountains and valleys and streams and weathering of every type. On top of that, millions of years of mountains and valleys and streams and weathering of every type. On top of that, millions of years of mountains of, or option two, worldwide supernatural flood lays out dead straight layers stacked on top of dead straight layer that go like giant pancakes for hundreds of miles. You just look at the picture and you could decide which one's true. In my mind, that screams out flood. Screams out flood. Now, what about the stuff? Where did the stuff for those layers come from? This is shocking. This is the Navajo sandstone. They did studies on the granules of Navajo sandstone, and they were shocked to discover it came from the Appalachian Mountains 1,500 miles away. The water's taken off the top of the Appalachian Mountains and bringing the sandstone out there to the layers. That's transcontinental transportation that requires a flood. What carved the canyon, what actually carved it, is a second issue. When you look at the canyon from the air, you could see that the river comes in at 2,800 feet. It exits at 1,800 feet, but in between the lines is altitude with the snow indicating elevation. From the side, it looks like this. River coming in at 2,800 feet, exit 1,800 feet, and the elevation goes up to 8,500 feet. Now, here's a question. If that river really carved that canyon for 5 to 8 million years, how did it do it uphill? That's a problem. And where did it take the material to? If it was dumping all that material, there's like millions of cubic yards of material missing from that canyon. If it was dumping it in the Gulf of Mexico, the Gulf of Mexico would be almost be full. It was dumping it off the coast of California, would literally have two giant, giant states sticking out there. It's not doing that because that's not what carved the canyon. You got, after the flood, a mile of wet sediment all oozing material upwards, making massive post-flood lakes. The uplifts are still soft. As the lakes become more full of water and more full of water, there's pressure on the still soft uplifts. There's basically a breach in the dam, and a whole bunch of material gets thrown out real fast over 3 or 4 states. It's exactly what we saw at Mount St. Helens. It explodes, water gushes out, carves this canyon, now called the Mini Grand Canyon. If you look at that, you know, like 300 years from now, they'd say, oh, that took thousands of years to make that. Look at that. No, it actually took a couple minutes, whole lot of water in a couple minutes. And it laid down layers very rapidly. Now that looks like thousands of years of layers, because I was taught in my classes that like one layer is a year, at least minimum. Well, that's actually 3 days. 3 days. Here was a lesson for me at the Grand Canyon. I get my Bible. I want to go worship the Lord. And I have to go far away from the group, because I sing like a frog that got run over by a truck. I go far away, I open my Bible, I start worshiping the Lord, and obviously I'm gonna read about the flood again, even though I read it so many times. And after I read it, I started to cry. And I don't really cry a lot. I started to cry because I realized I was sitting in a massive, unending grave with millions of fossilized creatures. And the reason for the flood in the Bible is clearly explained. Sin and violence filled the earth completely. And God brought judgment on that generation, on the earth. And I started to cry because I hadn't realized the gravity of sin, the power of God. And you know, I thought I was a good guy. Like before I knew the gospel, before I read the Bible, I thought I was a good, like, I'm a good guy, I should go to heaven. Then I started reading the Bible and I read, honor God, honor his name, honor his image. And I'm like blowing off God. I don't need anything to do with God. And then as I read more of the Bible, I realized that I thought I was a good guy, but the reality was my soul was literally covered in the filth of my own sin. And I thought I was a good guy. I deserved to go to heaven. And I knelt down before the Lord and asked him to forgive my sins. And because of what he did on the cross for me, he forgave my sins. And I just got to tell you, man, this sin stuff, he's in love with you. Like literally in love with you. You are his creation. You have an eternal soul. He is in love with you. But this sin makes such a wall between us and him. And sometimes we just leave that wall there and it damages our relationship with God. And if you realize, when you realize you got sin and you need forgiveness, I want to encourage you, come to God. He paid the ultimate price to forgive your sin. When Jesus died on the cross, I mean, I know, you know, you watch movies and you see him getting whipped and beaten. That wasn't the worst part of the cross. The worst part of the cross, I could never really film. The worst part of the cross is when God took my sin and your sin and put it on him on the cross. But it's also the most beautiful part of the cross, because in that moment, he took the punishment for my sin. He paid the price for my sin. And God says, when you realize that you're a sinner and you realize what Jesus did for you, you need to come to him and ask him to forgive your sins. Maybe you're here today, and obviously at the beginning of the service, it was so clearly explained that we are in the presence of God. And when we're in the presence of God, he just knows our heart. He knows what you're going through. He knows the struggles you're having. I realized last night, as a wise woman spoke one sentence into my life, that I had a part of me that needed some healing. And so when we're in the presence of God, that's when God comes and speaks to you. So we are going to open up the altar this morning, which is nothing. It just means you could come forward if you need to pray in the presence of God. If you need somebody to pray with you in the presence of God, we're going to just kind of have music for a couple minutes. And if you need to be in the presence of God and you need to talk with him, or kids, maybe kids, you've never asked God yourself to forgive your sins, I'd encourage you to come with a parent and do that. So we're just going to open up the altars this morning as the music plays. I'll be the first one down there because I do need healing in a certain part of my life. So I'm going to pray for that.
Thanks for listening. That wraps up today's word. We are grateful you joined in. And if you would like to hear more or learn more about us, feel free to check things out over at newriverchurch.org.